We've got Dana online here. Let's get our report from Dana Durnford up in British Columbia. Are you getting nailed by the polar vortex up there, Dana? How are you?
Good, thank you, Jeff. Yeah, we are. So it's a lot of frost, and normally you don't get any frost along this coastline maybe 3 or 4 days a year, right down on the shoreline, because you're in the rainforest zones. So we are getting hammered, and that's really unusual for this time of the year. We never see it until January, February, any frost whatsoever. You might see a little tiny bit for a few hours, but then it's gone again. So temperatures are coming up starting tomorrow, and they're going to be up +8 each day. And so we're back in the green light to go again real quick here. Just going to give it another few days. And up the coastline, I just wanted to touch on what Yoshi was talking about with Chernobyl. Chernobyl, 3% of the children that the mothers were pregnant at the time, 3% of those children that were born were healthy. The rest had issues from during Chernobyl. 3 million children required treatment. That was at Kofi Annan in 2000 because of Chernobyl. So Chernobyl was a real bad one. And another quick one I wanted to touch on with Yoshi because it reminded me, talking about Monsanto and GMO, was who won the war in Iraq and Afghanistan again? That was Monsanto, right? They
yeah.
Got the rights. What you done was they got rid of the patents and everybody's pension, mind you. But they got rid of the patents, and all you had to do was describe the plant and you can get the patent on it. And Monsanto already had it all prearranged and everything ready to go. And they scooped almost everything there. And Afghanistan is not allowed to grow indigenous plants for at least another 20 years. They're only allowed to grow Monsanto. Well, Monsanto won the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. There can be no doubt about
That's a very good point. Very bad point, but a very important
very
point.
Very bad point. But it is.
Wow.
And GMO, of course, if folks don't really understand it. It has 5 toxins and dioxins engineered into it that were never in your foods. And these prohibit you from uptaking the nutrients and macro and micro minerals. And so it's a really bad thing to mix in with your food. Organic. When you eat organic, you want to get and do dishes, go for a walk, you want to go do something. When you eat the GMO, you don't want to do anything. You're lethargic and you just feel really bad and you got to use the washroom. It's just a bad experience every time when you mix it in. I've noticed that. You can't even cheat and go get some GMO at the corner shop. It'll still get you every time. You miss that energy, right? You got to have that energy. And you will see it if you eat organic. You eat an organic meal. That's what it feels like. You're just full of energy.
Of course, it's living. It's live. Well, you're eating live food. You're eating life.
Nutrients and minerals. Novel idea, eh?
Yeah.
Minerals and nutrients in your food.
It's amazing.
No, Chernobyl. Like Yoshi was saying, that contaminated everywhere. You know, North America and South America.
Well, it pasted Europe, and nobody talks about it. No one talks about it.
And I do have some of the models of that dispersal way back in the day from other countries.
Mm-hmm.
And so all those countries got hammered. And I mean, they got hammered. And that was a 30% meltdown. That was only one-third the size of any of the reactors at Fukushima.
Correct.
And it wasn't using the MOX fuel, which is, you know, 2 million times worse than any other reactor. So the elements are completely different animals than any other radioactive element ever created by man because of that MOX concoction that they use. And the my theory on it was, and still and will always stand the test of time as far as I'm concerned, is that these elements they were using, the MOX fuel, they don't need that kind of stuff to make energy. They were using it for directed energy weapons to produce the isotopes to power the more powerful directed energy weapons for that space war. That certainly has been backed up. Remember, I can't remember the name of the guy, but they were making a plane, a 727, for about 30 years, and they put a airborne laser into it. It was a father and son team. And he'd done an interview on where he was saying they were using isotopes for power because this thing uses so much power, but it'll eat up the canisters in about 20 minutes. And so I never forgot that. And back in those days, I was kind of buying into this stuff, and I didn't understand the significance of what I was buying into. But I never forgot that. And that helped me in the research down the road when I started looking at it. And directed energy weapons, they need an enormous amount of power, and the only thing that can really compact, like a gram of radiation, a gram of the fuel rods, rather, is 1 million watts. And that can be a million watts for 18 months. And so it's an enormous amount of energy in a very tiny package. And to shoot a powerful laser that can destroy something 100 miles away or a few hundred miles away just is an enormous amount of energy to pull it off with the technology that they're using. And they are using the wrong technology because this particular stuff was never meant to be on our planet. It's a total fabrication that it has any uses whatsoever.
Correct.
And I'll jump over, unless you got a question there.
Go ahead.
It's directed energy weapons, and that's the future. That is the complete future. And so they need the nuclear fuel and the plants to create their concoctions, their witches' brews. And so every other country is competing to do the same thing. In Israel, of course, which is one of the most evilest things imaginable, they used it on Gaza, and I documented that myself. I got the actual footage of it. And there can be no mistake on what it is and what it's doing. And that was an experimental show-off, because Gaza is a place where they use their weapons. Israel uses its weapons to show it off to other countries.
And well, it's like an open-air laboratory to do exactly that demo.
It is.
Perfect, to test everything out. I completely agree. Go ahead. We're going to go through the break on this one. I'm going to make sure we get enough from Dana. Go ahead, Dana, please.
These directed energy weapons, I just want to just go a little bit further down the rabbit hole for everybody, is the consequences of using these things without no, it's like GMO, where we have no long-term knowledge about what's going on here and what the implications are and what the blowback from these weapons and the leftover materials and everything else, and then the concoctions that they have to put together in secret because they can't do it publicly. They want to hide it from other countries, allegedly. And this whole maniacal system, we got to create a more powerful and more bigger and a more badder weapon, but yet every country is out there trying to outdo every other country. And ultimately, it can't end good, right? It can only end bad. And the nuclear industry has no use. There's only 3% of the energy on the entire planet, but that's the disguise, right? Power by a nuclear plant is a proxy of the nuclear process itself. You need a million gallons a minute to cool it of water, and besides the fact that that million gallons of water, they're boiling all the larvae, all the eggs, all the small fries, and a million gallons in a minute, and that's just a byproduct of creating these weaponized isotopes. So nuclear power will never be the shining light that it was claimed. It can never be that. It's only for one purpose, and it's for war. So nothing good will come out of war, ultimately. The carnage you leave behind for the good that it done is irrelevant. It's like the Taliban, 11,000, and we fired 5.5 million rounds a month to get 11,000 gangbangers, basically.
Mm-hmm.
We killed a couple of million people to get 11,000 gangbangers. We created 5 million orphans in Afghanistan to get 11,000 gangbangers. We got millions in refugee camps, around 6 million, to get 11,000 gangbangers. We got 4 million missing to get 11,000 gangbangers, and a couple of million dead to get 11,000 gangbangers.
Yeah, 2 to 3 million dead in Afghanistan.
At least, at minimum, I always say 2 million just to lowball it, but we know it has to be more than that at 5.5 million rounds a month. And 2 million rounds of that came from McAllister's bomb manufacturing facility in McAllister, Oklahoma. And all they make is dirty bombs. So it's a relentless thing we've done to the planet. And the only way forward is people like yourself and Yoshi that are really pushing back in a really articulate way, and so that people become articulate too and are able to have a debate and have a discussion with real narratives. And that's what you guys are bringing to the table every week now for years, and we're catching up on this end, me and the Fukushima Hounds and many other people. But the urgency is real. And if people are not familiar, I go up the coastline in a 24-foot Zodiac, and we take pictures of the coastline. And so since I've been home in the last week and a half, I've uploaded day 18, day 17, day 16, 15, 14, day 13, 12, and I'm working on day 11. And these are huge files, and it's a massive amount of footage to get uploaded. But that's the data they use to beat up the system with. Mm-hmm. And what it done was it annihilated the coastline of British Columbia. For anybody that's not familiar with this, there was 6,500 species of invertebrates with the backbones. We never found none. And we were looking at the tidal pools and the nurseries of the ocean. These were all recognized by the University of Simon Fraser University, University of Victoria. Had everybody went out and found these species. We can't find them. Out of 480 species of worms, we never found any. And out of 78 species of sea anemones, we found 5 extremely sparse. And same with all the other species, very sparse. And obviously the ocean can't sustain it any longer. And, you know, as I go up the coastline, it's heartbreaking to see 4 or 5 species on a beach when there should be 500 or 600 on just a little tidal pool. And we never even found that in the entire coastline collectively. We maybe total, once we go through all the pictures, and I did find another species yesterday I never seen before in one of the pictures, was a nudibranch, one of the species of the nudibranches, and they eat the sea anemones.
Generally speaking, how many species have you observed so far? I was quoting around 20 total for most of your trip so far.
At any given spot, usually at best you might see 20 if you're really lucky, but they were the same species you would find everywhere else. And you would
that was the point.
Species.
About 20
yeah,
total.
Yeah, one extra species in those spots. Each spot you would find an extra 1 or 2 species, but you wouldn't find it in the spot before and you wouldn't find it in the spot after usually. Mm-hmm. And so that's how we come up with those numbers. But altogether, I got 24 to 28, but when I count the algae, there was around 20 species of algae out of 600. And so each tidal pool should have had 100 to 200 to 300 species of algae alone. And so everything is missing. The tidal, the insects are missing on the coastline.
No bugs still, huh? None.
No bugs. We never found. And then there's all the creek insects, what I call insects, the invertebrates that live in a really, at the high tide line, and the bacteria in that. We don't smell any of that during the summer or the fall. And there was nothing anywhere, as you know, Jeff, but most people are not familiar with it. This is real, and you know, all we're doing is taking pictures, folks, and then we're publishing that up on the Internet as we get a good Internet connection. And in the hopes that the academic world will come to their senses and say, okay, we can't sustain this anymore.
You know, I think, I hate to say this, but
I know.
They're cowards. They're not going to give up their jobs. They're not going to give up their careers. They won't do it. You're right.
No,
it's a wonderful thing to hope for. I agree with you. They're cowards.
That's all I'm doing is hoping.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to keep going in case that information is useful for people. Because to me, it says everything I ever need.
Well,
to
you're say. Documenting. You are the one person, literally, on the planet who is
documenting
this.
Everybody else looked at the tuna and the bigger fish, and they bioaccumulate. They don't get affected the same way as the filter feeders and the stuff in the nurseries, the most vulnerable.
Right.
So that made common sense, but I couldn't find anybody doing it. And so that's why we went ahead and done it, of course. And this is not just me. This is a whole lot of people. Incredible amount of people.
Apparently, Buesler, again, is saying, well, we've identified 137 or 134 in the water, but it's very, very minor, and it's not everywhere, and it's not a problem. That guy has really, in my opinion, changed his tune almost 180 degrees from what it was in the very beginning. Somebody obviously shut him up. Arnie Gunderson has also been very quiet lately, and the general flow of news, Yochi, out of ENE and out of Japan is a trickle of what it was a year ago.
If you're lucky.
Yeah, we're not getting much out of TEPCO. Nothing from Fukushima. It's incredible. And a few scientists are harping at the edges, you know, hinting, but no one's coming out really directly. So, terrible situation. So, you know, it just means we have to do more intervention, you know, and then this is a real hassle to go in there to Japan, do testing again. And where Dana is at, I think one of the things we're starting to see is that all the salmon raising areas and salmon capturing areas, except for Chile, is affected by Fukushima. The Norwegian reindeers are affected, definitely the waters in Norway, the fjords. You know, it's running off from the creeks into the fjord, from the glaciers into the fjord, so there's radiation in salmon. You okay? So I think people should start considering taking dosimeters, because salmon is a very popular food, especially among people who are health conscious, omega-3 oils and all that. you know, a lot of people get their, most of their protein from salmon. I think they, a lot of people feel shy, you know, feel very embarrassed or nervous to take out a dosimeter in a supermarket. I walk into the supermarket in Japan and I measure. People stare at me. They get alarmed, eyes open. But, you know, I just tell them, I have to do this because I'm not going to eat a radioactive fish, you know? And I have a right to do this. And so I think people got to exercise that right and start using dosimeters on salmon and start reporting that to the Rent Show. I think you know, we've got to hear what's happening in the supermarket shelves there, in the counters there, to find out what exactly is happening. You know, because they do bring krill. Most of that food is krill from the southern sea, from Antarctic, feed it to the fish, but the fish are constantly exposed to radioactive water and plankton and all whatever else up there in the northern cold waters. So we've got to be much more now. I think there's been enough time for to see the levels in salmon. And these salmons are a few years old, so they're accumulating. They're accumulating like crazy.
Well, last year, the fishermen in Alaska pooled their own money because the government wouldn't help them and had their fish tested. And they were coming back with consistent readings. They weren't terribly high, but they were consistent, indicating there's a bioaccumulation.
That was a while back,
That's right. That goes back a year ago and maybe a little longer.
That's it.
We're going to see this all begin to change for the worse here. We've always said it would be incremental. We never said it was going to be a slam dunk like the garage door comes down on you. Not going to happen like that.
Yeah, it doesn't work that way, but it's getting to be critical now. I mean, where people really got to start watching it.
We don't know how much of the Pacific Ocean.
The
Pacific Ocean may be already 3/4, 4/5 dead. We don't know. What was the fisheries people off Santa Barbara the last time you were on? I read them. What they said. They said all they're seeing is clear water with no fish.
Yeah.
And I lived.
Obviously, it's seen the greatest kill off in modern history. Dana is at, why he's been watching the greatest ever kill off, which cannot be from storm drains from Seattle because the water from Seattle doesn't flow up there. So it's obviously radiation.
You know, I was going to say one thing to Dana. I lived right on the beach on the ocean for 9 years in Santa Barbara. And watched the seasons change. They didn't change too much overtly down there, but they changed. And we would have, of course, in the summer, the kelp beds out there would, you know, big pieces of kelp would break off, constantly washing up on the shore. And flies, the smells would change, everything. And what Dana's saying is no flies, no smell, no decay. There's no life to die off anymore.
Right. That's right.
Yeah.
You don't see anything at night.
Aseptic.
That's what it is. Go ahead, Dana.
Well, no, you know, as I went up the coastline, I was expecting to see more life. I really truly was, in one sense, to find pockets of life where there was just that normality that I'm used to seeing as an ex-commercial diver on this coastline. And after 60 days, not counting the first trip, we never seen nothing. The second trip for 60 days was shocking. That was shocking. How could the wildest coastline, most pristine coastline in Canada, absolutely stunning, and you don't get ice in the wintertime, folks. And ice will crush the coastline. It'll pack in on the coastline. The winds will blow it up and it'll scrub the coastline. BC doesn't get that. And so everything should be loaded. Every square inch should be completely full, and there should be up to 9,500 species minimum, and there's over 4 million species in the Pacific Ocean. And for us to go up there and every day find just a handful of species, and the major species was the beak mussels, the beak barnacles, the kelp weed, and the kelp cabbage. If those four disappeared, there's nothing else there. There'll be nothing there to hang on and live into. There's nowhere for anything to hide into. It'll be completely, utterly naked.
Wow.
And so they're very sparse. They're very few. They're very thin. They're very weak looking. They're very spread out. And so it can happen anytime at all at this
stage. Dana is up there. Briefly, Dana, then we got to get moving here and get some information from Yochi. But what is your schedule right now? When do you expect to be able to get back in the water? I guess the big part of the storm has passed, and you're going to start back up on your trip.
Right. We're going to, this trip here is going to be by myself.
What?
For 30 days? Yeah, for 30 days.
And you're gonna take. Wait. Hold on. You're gonna take the Zodiac by yourself.
Yeah, I am.
And what are you gonna do at nights?
So every two or three nights, I'll pull into a community and go into a hotel and clean up and blah 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 and get on the phone and everything else and try to upload some stuff. But so the idea is to go from town to town and in between each town, cover that whole coastline and then drop the pick for the night, tie onto the shore with a stern anchor, out in the water rather, and so you can't drift away, kind of, and get up the next morning, catch the tides, and just work your way up to the next community, and then go to that community and go to the radio station, go to TV, go to newspapers, go to the local leaders in the community and see if I can get interviews with them, see if I can get them to have a lecture or a presentation in each of these communities.
This is incredible. You're doing this alone?
Yeah.
My God.
Yeah, I'm going to do it on my own because, well, it's cheaper to do it that way. It's a very expensive operation to run. It's very difficult to run four guys and move around the coastline with RVs.
You shouldn't be alone out there, my friend. I know you're a real ocean man, but this is not good. All right.
It's good. I installed eBerk today in case the boat tips over. They're $1,100, and they'll send out an emergency indicator. But that boat can't sink anyway. I'm not worried about that kind of routine. 26,000 islands up here to hide onto, and I know the coastline inside out. And the operation truly is probably, it's a highball operation, but it's one of the safest operations I've ever seen. Got every piece of equipment imaginable for safety and comfort, total comfort. Redone the whole boat, done the cabin on it, all new interior, new everything. So all equipment is brand new.
You got more guts than I do, and it reminds me of Yochi taking his trips to Fukushima on a bicycle going right in there.
That takes nerve.
It takes a lot. Well, listen, I wished you had one thing. Somebody to call ahead for you to the next town or community that had a newspaper or a radio station and let them know you were coming in, you're on a research expedition. It's a perfect news story for them.
Right. And then try to bring them out with me, too. You know, I agree with you wholeheartedly. That's the plan. Like you say, it's a lot to do what we're doing, what I've done up to this point. And what I'm going to do next is going to be even harder, more difficult, more arduous. But the job has to get done. There's too much urgency. You can't go and look at the coastline like I've done and not be impacted forever, no matter what. You know, that affects me all the time.
You are doing a service for humanity, for the planet, and I don't have to speak for Yochi, but we really honor what you're doing.
I appreciate it.
It's extraordinary, truly.
It's getting done. That's the job that got to get done. Someone's got to do it. Got to be somebody that can't compromise. You bet. Okay,
all right. You take care of yourself.
Yeah. Thank you, Jeff. Good night, Yochi, everybody. Take care.
Okay, Dana.
Good luck to you.
Thank you, Yochi. Okay, folks. Good night.
Good night, Dana.